Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Romero v. State.
May it please the court, Mr. David Jowers will present argument from petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes to rebut.
This is a drug forfeiture case in which the state seeks to forfeit petitioner's home.
Could you speak louder?
Yes, sorry. This is a drug forfeiture case in which the state seeks to forfeit petitioner's home, which she inherited from her mother. Petitioner earned $6 per hour and took this appeal as an indigent. The forfeiture was based on two alleged sales of cocaine by petitioner's former boyfriend in her presence. The state contends in its briefing that petitioner's role was to help the buyer arrange the money to the buyer's satisfaction. The appraised value of petitioner's home is $46,000. According to the undisputed affidavits, neither petitioner nor her property has ever been connected with drugs apart from the two transactions in question.
Were these transactions to an informant?
Yes.
Ms. George, she was charged with two events. She was found not guilty for one and found guilty in the other. And for what she was found guilty, what was the range of punishment?
5 to 99 years, I think.
I'm sorry?
5 to 99 years, I think.
And what was the range of fine?
I'm not sure. I think it's $20,000, but the state could be more accurate.
The state's brief said $50,000, but I didn't know if that was a distinction between what she was charged with as opposed to what she was found guilty of. So I didn't know. But there is a pretty substantial fine for this thing.
I did. This case is thus distinguishable from cases involving so-called instrumentality forfeitures. As stated in Austin versus United States, there is nothing even remotely criminal in possessing a home like petitioner's. This case also does not involve any proceeds of illegal activity or any true contraband such as controlled substances or other property which is unlawful to produce or possess.
Ms. George, under Austin, the Supreme Court said that there was still an issue as to whether or not the forfeiture was excessive. The forfeiture in relationship to the crime that was committed raised the question, or at least sent it back to the appellate court for a determination of excessiveness. Is that correct?
That's correct for purposes of the excessive fines clause.
If the appellate court found that the forfeiture was not excessive in relation to the crime that was committed, would the state be permitted to forfeit the property under Austin?
In this case?
I'm just talking about in the Austin case, the facts of that case, if the appellate court had found that the fine was not excessive, would the state have been permitted to forfeit, to take the property?
Oh, sure, because there was no double jeopardy issue involved in Austin. For double jeopardy, all there has to be is a punishment. The excessiveness of it's not even an issue.
Austin had been convicted of a crime, had he not, before this issue on forfeiture came up? Right, are you saying that issue just wasn't before the Supreme Court and double jeopardy?
I guess the issue wasn't before the court, because it's not discussed at all in the case.
To be clear, you've not raised an excessiveness fines clause problem?
Not before this court. I did raise cruel and unusual punishment before the trial court. But
so our only concern here is double jeopardy?
Yes, sir, and the unconscionability of the contract and the total circumstances, in which the thing was signed.
Was the agreement, when the agreement was made to split the proceeds, was she represented by counsel?
Yes.
Was that you?
Yes.
As a plea bargainer,
Pardon me, Your Honor.
It was a plea bargain agreement?
It was a, yes, sir, a settlement agreement. With respect to the criminal case, that was a contested trial before the court.
In other words, she had already been found guilty and sentenced before the settlement agreement was reached?
Yes.
And this was just a settlement of whether they were to take all or part of the house?
Right.
What is the practical answer? If you're right about double jeopardy, what does they have to bring this in a criminal case like the Ninth Circuit says?
Right, bring it on the same proceeding or elect not to to bring the criminal case. And that only makes sense because, you know, the way the fact finder does these things on punishment, in a criminal case, you weigh all the options. And if the state wanted to have the fact finder consider this, it ought to have been, you know, put in the equation with all the other options. For example, the court may have given less, you know, in a hypothetical case, I suppose, might be inclined to give less probation time, you know, and then forfeit, or, you know, more of a civil fine and then a forfeiture, or, you know, weigh it all together.
The Ninth Circuit says you've got to bring it in the indictment and the same burden of proof would apply. Why is that necessary? Why couldn't you have a split burden of proof in a case like this? Assuming that you had a double jeopardy problem.
I'm not sure that you couldn't have a split burden of proof. The Supreme Court, I guess it was in Austin, said that you know, the full panoply of criminal protections, and I guess that includes burden of proof, would apply in one of these cases if it was so punitive as to be criminal. So I guess that would not, you know, apply all forfeiture cases.
Mr. George, does the Halper opinion, which talks about these civil fines and forfeitures being double jeopardy, does it say that that's the end of the inquiry?
For double jeopardy purposes?
Yes, sir.
No, it doesn't.
Doesn't Halper, in fact, say the state has an opportunity to demonstrate that the forfeiture or the civil fines bear a relationship to the cost of prosecuting and the cost of this crime?
Yes.
So isn't that an issue that's left open for double jeopardy that means that there's additional step before double jeopardy attaches?
In the case of the forfeiture, that is the subsequent case, because if the forfeiture is first, you know, the criminal prosecution can't be had at all. But in the case where the forfeiture is second, as it was in Halper?
Or as it is in this case.
Right.
There's an additional step remaining before the state is foreclosed from asserting forfeiture.
I don't think there is, because I think this case is distinguishable from Halper for the reason set forth in Austin, namely it doesn't involve a small fixed penalty provision you know, like the one in Halper. You know, Supreme Court in Austin said you don't have to do a case-by-case basis, where on the face of the statute, like the one here, any relationship between the government's cost is purely incidental.
But isn't that in the context of an allegation that the fine's excessive as opposed to the double jeopardy?
Yes, that is an excessive fine.
Now, I don't remember which opinion, but doesn't Judge Scalia in one of those opinions make the note that forfeiture is no different than a fixed fine? One is just a penalty in kind, another one is just penalty in cash?
Yes.
I can't remember. Is that the Halper case?
I think it's the Austin case.
Whatever. So he says that forfeiture is the same thing as a fine, civil fine.
Yes.
Why wouldn't Ms. Romero signed a settlement agreement for this forfeiture matter? The question I have, understanding Austin and Halper, is it your position that under no circumstances whatsoever, would the state have had a colorable claim to her house?
No. I mean, I think that's true, but I don't think that that's You know, I don't think that that the petitioner is required to show that to prevail. You know, on the unconscionability, the gross disparity in the party's bargaining positions.
Can't agree to waive your rights. You can even waive your double jeopardy rights.
Oh, sure, but I don't think that's the issue here because, if anybody contends, if there had been any such express waiver in the settlement agreement, which there wasn't, but if there had been one, it would suffer from the same, infirmities as the rest of the contract. In other words, unconscionable, just like the rest of the contract. So I don't think that's an issue.
So it couldn't, I guess under your view of the case, it couldn't be conscionable under any such circumstances.
It could not be conscionable under any circumstances? I don't think so in the circumstances of this case. Given the tangential relationship and merely incidental and fortuitous relationship between the property and the offense, given the fact that you're talking about family homestead, you find cases all over the place that talk about the historical protection that a homestead is given, especially in Texas.
Was this agreement unconscionable on the day before the Austin decision was handed down?
Yes, I think so.
So what difference did the Austin decision make? Why do you rely so heavily on the Austin decision?
Well, part of the part of the reason that I say that this thing is unconscionable, you consider the whole setting in which it was signed, and previous decisions of courts in Texas and basically all federal decisions, none of them had ever held, or virtually 99% of them had never held that the forfeiture was improper, it was excessive, or that it constituted punishment for double jeopardy purposes. This is exemplified by the opinion of the Dallas Court of Appeals in this ex parte Rogers case. Of course, Dallas is where any appeal from this case would have gone to. In Rogers, the court said that what you compared a forfeiture to for a proportionality analysis was the millions of dollars the government's being forced to spend generally on drug abuse programs, and that's no test at all. No forfeiture at all could ever be found.
When the drug sale was transacted, was Mrs. Romero living in the home at that time?
Yes.
Because there was something in the state's brief about it was no one lived there.
She moved out subsequent to the sometime
when they were going to sell it.
Yes.
What was her sentence in the criminal trial?
She received the minimum. She received 5 years probation on one of the two offenses, no fine, and was found not guilty of the other. And that's another thing, incidentally, why I say that this is so unfair, is that one fact finder had the opportunity to consider an additional civil sanction against, well, not civil, but an additional monetary sanction against her, decided that she, her participation in the offense did not merit one.
If Ms. Romero had been sentenced to what you believe to be the maximum fine of $20,000 and 99 years in prison, would that have been subject to an Eighth Amendment challenge for excessiveness?
No, I don't think so. I think confinement, I looked at that, I considered that question. The way I understand the case law, and I didn't spend a lot of time with this, but the way I understand it is that, period of confinement is cruel and unusual punishment clause kind of stuff. And, frankly, you never see a case, I looked for this, you never see a case where they say the confinement amount of punishment is excessive. All the cases ever say is, well, it's within the range of punishment.
I understand that you haven't raised, I understand that you say excessiveness is not raised here, but under the Austin rationale, would the fact that one half of the house was within the range of punishment of fine that would be permitted under the criminal statute be one factor for determining whether or not this was an excessive punishment?
It is, under the test announced in some of these recent Eighth Amendment excessive fines cases. Other cases don't rely on that. So for some cases, yes, and for others, no.
So under that rationale, there could be a question as to whether or not, if Austin literally applied in this case, that would be one of the considerations of whether or not what was forfeited here was within a range that the statute would have permitted to have been done under the criminal context.
I think at least under some cases, but I do think that the thrust of most of these cases nowadays is a so-called instrumentality approach, looking at the nexus between the property and the offense, and then that sort of thing wouldn't appear.
That would be another consideration.
Yeah, you know, the amount of sentences for similar offenses, the amount of possible sentences wouldn't seem to be relevant to that.
Any other questions?
One quick question: if you had appealed this case, if you had not settled, and you had appealed the forfeiture, you would have the same arguments you have in front of us today, except the unconscionability claim. Is that accurate or not?
Yes.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Palmer.
May it please the court, Mr. Gerard DeLazio will present argument for the respondent.
Mr. DeLazio, before we get to the forfeiture itself, I am still not clear about the underlying criminal action. There were two, Ms. Romero was indicted on two different transactions.
Yes, sir.
And she was tried before a jury.
Yes, sir.
She was found not guilty as to one transaction.
She was found not guilty on the second transaction wherein there was an attempted sale of cocaine.
And she was found guilty as to one transaction.
The first transaction.
And her participation was assisting her boyfriend in providing the place for this transaction.
Yes, sir.
All right. And what was her sentence?
She had 5 years probation.
No fine.
No fines.
Was there any discussions at all about forfeiture with the trial defendants and judge?
Judge, I was not present, but it's not the practice in Dallas County that that be the case.
But there was a pre-sentence investigation as the usual case.
Yes, sir. Civil seizures are handled in Dallas County out of the civil section of the district attorney's office. Criminal prosecutions are clearly handled out of the prosecution section of the DA's office. There is no interaction. They are separate proceedings.
Other than Ms. Romero providing the place for a drug transaction, which he was sentenced to 5 years probation, what was the connection of the house to that transaction she was found guilty?
The house was essential to the sale of cocaine, to the unlawful, felonious sale of cocaine.
It was
the meeting place.
What was the amount?
The first...
the amount that she was found guilty of participating in.
2 ounces, which is approximately 62 grams. The sentence, the statutory exposure for such an offense is life, 5 to 99 years, or a fine of $50,000.
The fact is she got 5 years probation, that indicates to me that this was her first offense?
Yes, sir.
And she had no prior record of any kind?
Yes, sir.
And you stipulate to that?
No, sir. I can only answer what I know from the record. I did not participate in that proceeding. But I will say, Your Honor, that the fact that she got a 5 year probation for this type of offense would indicate to me, as a lawyer of 8 years in the DA's office, that that's probably the case. I would like to clarify a couple of points. This is not a settlement, this is not a plea bargain, it's a settlement agreement. It's a contract. Cowper determines or conceptualizes the relationship between a civil seizure and a forfeiture to the damage sustained by the government, the government of the people, who calls it rough justice. It can't be quantified. It's not a scientific assessment. And if the forfeiture is determined to be so excessive in the rare case and disproportionate to that damage, then Halper would suggest that double jeopardy applies and the forfeiture would be unconstitutional.
Austin suggests that any forfeiture is punishment and double jeopardy always applies, doesn't it?
Not necessarily, Justice.
All right.
Austin will
tell. It says, we therefore conclude that forfeiture under these provisions, statutory, not circumstances, constitutes payment to a sovereign as punishment for some offense.
Your Honor, it does.
So if forfeiture is punishment, then you've got a double jeopardy problem.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. The question remains under Halper, because Austin is not a double jeopardy case. Austin and Halper are distinguishable cases. As brilliant as they are distinguishable. Austin is an Eighth Amendment excessive fines case. Halper is a Fifth Amendment double jeopardy case. Point of fact, there's very little mention of double jeopardy in the lengthy discussion of the history of forfeitures in Austin going back to the Magna Carta.
Justice Austin does cite to Halper for the notion of punishment is punishment, doesn't it?
I will admit, Your Honor, that it does suggest that this history of judicial evaluation of forfeitures as fines would lead them to believe that it can be defined as punishment, that a civil seizure and forfeiture can be defined as punishment given the prior decision of Halper. Austin doesn't overrule Halper. They're just distinguishable cases.
What was the leverage the district attorney's office had on Ms. Romero at the time this agreement was entered into? Was she told, we're going to take your house, period?
Your Honor.
And what was do you have any leverage? Do you have any other charges pending or some, or what? What clout? You know, it seems strange.
Your Honor, on November 30, 1992, the state filed plaintiff's first amended original notice of seizure and intended forfeiture under Chapter 59 of the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure. That is a verified petition with an affidavit signed by the affiant officer as required by the statute. That's the only leverage. A very strong cause of action.
We're going to take your house.
We're taking your house.
It's worth $64,000 on a case that you got 5 years probation on because you allowed your boyfriend to do a transaction.
Your Honor, at the time that case is filed, that's 30 days from the date of seizure. At that point in time, the state has no idea what the resolution of the criminal case will be. I have had cases that have been filed within the 30-day statute of limitations where defendants have been acquitted, and we have still resolved or won the civil seizure. They're separate cases. They are not brought in one proceeding.
Is that true today, even since Austin?
That can very well be true today.
No, I'm asking you, is it?
Yes, sir, it is.
I mean, you still handle civil forfeitures and criminal proceedings separately.
Entirely different. I frequently don't even know who's handling the prosecution end of the case. I go forward with a civil seizure.
And you don't care what the sentence was because as far as you know, if they did drugs for any amount, you're going to take their property.
Under the law, Your Honor, the question of sentencing in the criminal case has no constitutional implication and does not provide a defense to the civil seizure. It's not mentioned in Austin. It's not mentioned in Halper. It's not mentioned in Fan. It's not mentioned in Rogers. And it's certainly not mentioned in the new statute that says that civil seizures in the state of Texas are now considered remedial forevermore.
You're taking the position that since the legislature has changed the heading on it, it's now fully remedial. But before they did that, is it your position that Halper did not require a district attorney to at least make an argument that the civil forfeiture was related to the cost of their prosecution? I'm saying you're saying Halper does not lead you to the conclusion that at least at that point, the prosecutor had to come in or the on the civil side, going after forfeiture, there had to be some demonstration that what you were taking was reasonably related to the cost of this crime, whatever it is.
No, Your Honor, what I'm suggesting is that I must prove a rational relationship between the offense and the size of the forfeiture.
And if you prove that, then you can proceed on your forfeiture under Halpern.
Yes, sir.
What's the rational relationship here?
The rational relationship is clearly defined under NICTUS. The house was used, clearly intended to be used, to commit the sale of cocaine. From a financial perspective, and the financial perspective is the damages or government damages sustained as anticipated by the Halpern decision. The tax value of the house is alleged to be $46,540. That's before the house became abandoned, and it's quite some time ago, so that's probably low. The total.
But now, you do agree that she was living there at the time of the offense?
Yes, Your Honor, she was definitely living there at the time of the offense. Not one criminal act was perpetrated. Two, the second time, the supplier was arrested in the backyard of the home.
Do you concede the fact that the house was not purchased through drug money?
I have no knowledge of what assets were used to purchase the home, Your Honor.
Well, it was a statement made that she had heard of this from her mother. Do you dispute that? Or do you have any basis to dispute that? Or?
No, I do not. In point of fact, Your Honor, there's no reason to suggest that that would be a legal defense. Not at all.
You didn't finishing your answer on the financial perspective. How did that relate to the
yes, Your Honor. Tax value of the house is alleged to be $46,540. The total value of the cocaine sold or intended to be sold was $8,750.
Is that for the transaction she was found guilty of? Or
both transactions.
Well, if you discount the transaction she was found innocent of, what is the value of the cocaine?
About $2,500.
$2,500.
Yes, sir. One half of $46,540 is $23,270. The ratio of the property loss to the forfeiture to the direct economic value of the crime is between 2 to 1 and 3 to 1. When you look at the 8750, that's true, Your Honor. The briefing analysis that we provided was the fact that the house was used first for the one transaction that she was found guilty of, and secondly, for the intent to use the house. In other words, if the case had gone to trial, we would have clearly proven that the house was used as an instrumentality of crime twice.
And you were despite the fact she was found innocent of any crime.
In the criminal court, not in the civil court. She never went to trial in the civil court. Entirely different standards in the criminal court.
So you don't see anything unconscionable about this transaction?
Not at all, Your Honor. Not at all. It's a crack house. Drug sales are being conducted. Drugs are serious, serious menace to the community. The damages to the community by a drug crime is very, very serious.
You say it's a crack house. I associate the term crack house, a house that usually has multiple transactions of crack cocaine. Was there any evidence of that? There was any crack cocaine being sold at this house?
I have reason to believe that if this arrest were not made on the second transaction, multiple transactions could have very easily been accomplished there. Could have conducted 10 transactions there.
What is the status of the house now?
It's abandoned.
Well, assume, as hard as it will be, that this is a double jeopardy problem. Does that still mean that the agreement in this case must be set aside or not?
Not at all.
Even if this were punishment for which she could not be put twice in jeopardy, the agreement you think is valid and why?
Assuming that the forfeiture constitutes double jeopardy, that's a conclusory legal matter. Therefore, it's possible that we might suggest that the agreement is unconstitutional and therefore the forfeiture is unconstitutional. However, under Green International versus State, a very important case now before this distinguished panel for oral argument in November, it has been determined that to sue under such a contract for damages, alleging it to be unconscionable, the state must clearly, as a matter of statute, waiver its sovereign immunity from suit and contract. And in Chapter 59, we do not find such a waiver. That defeats every one of the contract arguments of my adversary.
Any other reason?
To begin with, another reason would be that in this particular case, my adversary suggests he is before the court and the contract should be stricken or rescinded because Austin was determined the same day that the settlement agreement was executed. Halper was determined in 1989. Halper was the law. He suggests the law changed on the day that the settlement agreement was executed, and we say no. It has been suggested in the question that this is a double jeopardy case, but the case presented to the court is an Austin case, an excessive fine case. That's why my adversary suggests that this contract should be rescinded because of Austin. Austin changed the law. We believe, and we set forth a lengthy argument in our brief, that Austin really didn't change the law. Austin is merely a statement of a trend of law clearly defined both federally and at the state level in Texas. And we would rely on Halper, and we rely on Rogers, and Johnson versus State.
At least you say that the house is vacant. I take it Ms. Romero is still the record owner of the house, and the house has not been sold. Ask for your forfeiture.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's in limbo at the moment.
Yes, Your Honor. There's no reason why she can't live there if she wants to. She just apparently doesn't want to.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tom. You may proceed. Why was Austin such a change in the law?
I'm not sure it was. It clarified what the law was. I've cited cases indicating that I don't think it was such a change that it doesn't apply retroactively, for example. I do think that it makes it, the decision is at odds with the law as announced by the courts in Texas, which I think is incorrect.
If it was not a fundamental change in the law, if it's merely in line with Halper, then how can you set this agreement aside?
Well, the only contention that we've made that that's a problem with is mistake of fact / mistake of law. Otherwise, the agreement's unconscionable under the law of beforehand.
Even though you agreed to it, you're saying I should not have agreed to it because it's unconscionable ab initio.
Yes, sir.
You're the one that negotiated this on behalf of Ms. Romero?
Yes, sir. I think I've alluded to my explanation. I couldn't find any cases anywhere where a forfeiture had been found to constitute punishment for purposes of double jeopardy.
Are you a volunteer or you retain counsel?
I've always been pro bono.
Pro bono.
The state cannot ordinarily be sued on a contract without giving its permission. Can it be sued or rescind a contract under the doctrine of
self-immunity? I don't know the answer to that. That's the first time I've heard that. But, of course, the state would be in a position of having to sue her to enforce it, I suppose, wherein I would guess she could assert her defenses. I did want to answer the court's question on how come the double jeopardy wasn't raised in Austin. I looked at the case, and the reason, I guess, is because there were separate sovereigns involved. You know, the criminal action took place in the state courts, and the forfeiture was in the federal courts. And the case is pretty uniformly held that there's no double jeopardy problem when you have separate sovereigns. Also, I did look at one of the recent cases cited by the state, the excessive fine cases concerning the relationship of the property and the offense, and it doesn't mention anywhere the possible assessable range of fines could be assessed. Instead, it talks about, for example, nexus between the property and the offense, and none of these factors are present in this case. Whether the use of the property was incidental, whether the property was important to the illegal activity, whether the use of the property was isolated, whether the purpose of acquiring the property was to carry out the crime.
Mr. George, your position is that since they can't establish that, they would not be able to take forfeiture of the house. But if they had been able to establish that, then you agree that under Halper there was still an issue about whether or not the house could be forfeited.
I don't think it's an issue, I guess, created by Halper, only in the sense that Halper isn't specific enough to talk about this kind of situation. That's all. Halper doesn't say that, even under Halper there's a problem with this doing a forfeiture in this case, because I went back and read Halper pretty carefully. You see a lot of cases that cite it and they distort it, like this Rogers case. What Halper really says the issue is the purpose of the sanction in question, namely whether it bears any rational relation to the government's non-punitive purposes. And it's as explained in another case, United States versus Hudson, 14 Fed 3rd 536, merely because a sanction by coincidence is reasonably related to the government's costs doesn't mean that the purpose of the sanction is punishment.
Did you say you prosecuted this appeal pro bono?
Yes, sir.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument and the final call. All of these causes we've heard this morning are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.
Y'all, you please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez.